In terms of the as aspiring writers and authors, you know, having that community, whoever you deem to be important to be in that community, it is important, no matter how independent we are or how accomplished and, you know, capable of writing we may be. We all need that community.
You're listening to the No Labels, No Limits podcast with best-selling author Sarah Box. We focus on the mantra, no labels, no limits, no excuses. And now without further ado, please welcome your commanding coach with plenty of chutzpah and heart, Sarah Box.
Hey there, No Labels, No Limits podcast listeners. This is Sarah Box, your host, of course, the No Labels, No Limits podcast, where we're on a mission to help individuals, teams, and organizations, and especially our nonprofit friends, think outside the box, move beyond limiting beliefs, and create a profound impact in the lives of others. And, you know, we do this by sharing accomplished and inspiring guests who have challenged their own limiting beliefs or labels and pursued and accomplished personal and professional goals. I'm really excited to introduce today's guest to you because I know her personally. I'm a fan of hers. And I met her last fall. I'm not going to tell you who it is yet, so don't expect me to. But I met her last fall in a class, and now we were in this ongoing support and mastermind group working on projects where we learn more. And this is where I've learned more about her heart and why she does what she does, and just made me a deeper fan. So, but anyway, now I'll tell you who's coming on the podcast with us. Today we're having Carrie Kreisman. Now, she is a native of St. Petersburg, Florida. She's the former first lady of the city's. And she's on a journey to blend journalism, public relations, and a passion for writing and teaching. She has a long background in news and marketing at the St. Petersburg Times, and she has experience as the public relations manager at Creative Clay. Carrie has brought her expertise to various platforms, and she holds a BA in mass communications from the University of South Florida. So that's all good on her credentials, but here's what's some cool stuff. She is not just a writer, but she's also the author of the insightful memoir, Accidental First Lady, on the front line and behind the scenes of local politics, which is interesting topic when you think about what we see often is just the glossy front side of things. So she has a lot to share on that, what she's learned from that. And she also teaches memoir writing and speaking on writing and publishing. And she recently just finished a class in her local college area. But in addition to her literary pursuits, she contributes to a luxury travel magazine, Be Seeing You, and is a dedicated puppy raiser. This is my favorite part for the Southeastern Guide Dogs. Her involvement extends to pet therapy program at Tampa General Hospital, showcasing her love for animals and community service. So if that wasn't enough, when she's not writing or volunteering, she enjoys indulging in wine, walking her Labradors, exploring culinary delights, and immersing herself in binge-worthy historical fiction. So with all of that, let's formally welcome Carrie to the podcast. Hi, Carrie.
Hello, happy to be here, and wow, what an introduction. So,
I should have had you write a perfect introduction.
No, I'm thinking I should have written that. That's how I should write my bio. That was lovely, and thank you for the warm introduction and the invitation to be here today.
Well, I'm excited because on my business side, we're all about getting nonprofits to tell their story in different ways and compelling ways, and I know that's something that you are just like, that's your thing. You know, I don't want to say you're an expert or that's your niche, because it actually feels like it's more of your path of telling story. And we'll talk more about memoir piece. But you know, in your first book, Accidental First Lady, on the front lines and behind the scenes of local politics, you shared a candid look into your life as a political spouse. So Let me ask you first, what motivated you to write this book? And what do you hope readers will take away from it in terms of resilience or community and the power of storytelling?
Well, the idea came to me over a cup of coffee with a friend, and it's as simple as that. My husband started in politics, and I say we started, but he was the elected official in 1999 when our daughter was just over a year old. And, you know, the years go by and all of a sudden you wake up and we're like, wow, we've gone through 8 political campaigns, and this was 2018. So we were coming up on almost 20 years of politics. And by the time he finished, it was 22 years. But his final campaign was his reelection campaign to mayor of St. Petersburg. And it was all campaigns, no matter the level, whether it's a city council or a county commissioner, all the way up, obviously, to president, are difficult in their own ways. Anyone who desires to put themselves in the public arena and ask for someone's vote and also their money for advertising, which it costs a lot of money to run political campaigns. That's just a fact, and not sure if it'll ever change. But with that said, anyone who does that, it's not an easy road to walk. And no matter which side of the aisle you are on politically. But in recent years, I think we can all agree that politics has become more vitriolic. People are overall not as civically minded in a lot of ways. They don't believe in the power of their vote or the right and how hard fought it was to win the right to vote. So people are apathetic. But with social media and the effect that it's had on politics, it's made the atmosphere just really hard. And so with that said, his campaign of 2017 was his reelection campaign. Here in St. Pete, you can run for you can serve 2 consecutive terms. And so he was hoping to get a second term. And to give away the ending, he did, thankfully, you know, but leading up to that, it was hard. It pitted certain people in the city against each other. And we're a city of 270,000. We're Florida's 5th largest city. So this isn't, you know, a small town where, you know, everybody knows everybody. But it just, so people who weren't necessarily as involved in politics beyond voting, they were interested. They were involved. They were personally maybe affected and by it. So I had a friend, and we had served on a board of directors together. She happens to be the vice president of the Tampa Bay Rays, our baseball team. And she's also an adoptive parent. I'm an adoptive parent also. So we have had over the years several things in common, and we hadn't seen each other in a long time. So after the election, she said, let's go have coffee. You know, I haven't seen you in a while. And I'm like, let's catch up. I'm like, that'd be great. So we're having coffee. And she says, how do you do this? Like, as in, how do you live this life, this public life with all the nastiness and the negativity and the this and the that? And I, you know, I had an answer that I would give someone in while picking up my kids at school, or a stranger that would ask me a random question. You know, you're not going to get into it really with someone you don't know well, but you give them an answer. And, but with this person over coffee, just the two of us face to face, I told her how hard it had been in that campaign. And I was a seasoned political spouse. This was his 8th political campaign. And it was hard. It was very stressful in many ways. And, you know, I elaborated on a few points, and she said, she was astonished. And she said, you should write a book. And I had never thought about it. I really just was so involved in working, supporting my husband and the life that we had, which was really, now that we've stepped away, very, very busy. We knew it was busy, but not until you step away, how crazy it was for a long time. And raising our kids, most importantly, raising our kids. And so I just hadn't thought of it. And I did think about it after that. I was like, I like a project. Not that anyone needs to tell anyone that they should do this or shouldn't do that, but it just hadn't been a suggestion. It was like a light bulb went off for me. And I think a lot of us enjoy a buy-in on something that we want to embark on. So I asked my husband, I'm not asking for permission. I was asking for just, what do you think? And And he loved the idea. I bounced it off our media guy who had done my husband's commercials since 2006. He's in Nashville, and we've become friends over the years. And I texted him that day, and he's like, absolutely. He said, and this is what he said. He's run over probably 1,000 by now campaigns nationwide, done the media and messaging. He said, I would love a book for other political spouses. So that's how it started. I started writing it as a how-to for political spouses. And I, you know, was doing my outline, as rough as it may be, and coming up with my ideas and starting to write. And the more I started to write, I realized my advice was going to be the same in most situations regarding how you respond to situations, how you proceed or don't on social media, how you, you know, interface with your spouse and things like that. The advice was becoming the same and repetitive. I'm like, okay, this is, and then I thought, who am I to tell other people how to behave? I knew how I would proceed on, let's just say social media, for example. You know, I'm the type of person that writes the post but never hits send. On things that, you know, because you have to get it out when someone has attacked your husband or said something untrue. But then you have to ask yourself, is this going to matter in 5 minutes, 5 days, 5 years? And the answer is usually no. So, the idea of my book morphed into something different. And I decided to kind of back up a little bit and start at kind of at what I call the top, coming from a nonprofit background. You know, anyone who's in the arena will know that a mission statement is paramount to a nonprofit organization, whether you work for one or you're on the board. I've served on 6 different boards throughout the years. And, you know, it's always the mission statement. Everything we discuss and talk about, does it flow from the mission statement?
Does our mission star?
Yes, exactly. So I created a mission statement for my book, and that helped set me on the path. But as I wrote and just was trying to decide which stories to tell and which ones, even if they were a certain, you had to be there moment for me to leave out, were they pertinent to the mission statement? So that's how I started writing the book. And, it was definitely a learning process, and nothing like I'd ever done before, you know, having been writing for so many years.
So can you share your mission statement?
Yes, I should have had it.
Do you have it handy? Do you remember it?
The mission of Accidental First Lady is to share my stories of 22 years of political spouse life, the triumphs, the tragedies, resilience, and how to empower other political spouses, especially women, to learn how to find a satisfying life in politics and create their own brand apart from the public figure spouse.
So that shaped all the stories that you chose, right? Was that your litmus test? Does it serve the mission? Yes,
yeah.
No. And if it's no, it's somewhere else.
Right. It had to show, like, each of my chapters shows some sort of transformation that's important to, you know, within the larger realm of the 22 years. I mean, you can't tell everything from 22 years. And, you know, a memoir isn't necessarily, it's not your biography. You know, it's a snapshot. It can be a year in the life if that's how you want to tell your story. Mine was the segment of my life that was political. You know, and it was more than.
Let's talk about memoir, because I think people think about writing, right? And they think of memoir. You and I spoke about this briefly, and you wrote a nice piece on it about how people go, well, who cares, right? Who's going to care about my story or this section? So can you differentiate a little bit for me and for the listeners, memoir, journaling, or other types of just kind of writing, or even a novel, but not, I don't mean just even a novel, but separate the two so that someone who's thinking about a memoir can get their head wrapped around it maybe more clearly than thinking it's a biography, right? On day one.
Yeah. Well, a memoir is, you know, it can be a snapshot of a significant moment. You know, it depends how you write. We've all read different stories that are just in reality one big moment, or like I said earlier, 1 year. But a snapshot of that time in your life where you talk about your struggles, the emotions, and, you know, it, because it's about you, you have to summon the vulnerability within to share, rather than just, you know, there's a popular phrase, if you will, in the writing world, show, don't tell. I mean, we can tell what was on our grocery list. We can recite the list of 10 items that we went to go buy at the grocery store, or we can talk about our experience of walking in and the sights and sounds and who we may have run into that we know, or the, you know, the awesome sale they were having, the BOGO prices, and how we were so excited. I mean, that's taking the reader to that place and where they can connect with you. Memoir is a way to invite people into your world. And I think all books have the capacity to do that, but it's summoning those memories that are often locked away, not for any reason, but because I believe we all have a bandwidth of how much we can be remembering at any one moment. And it's, you know, so it's definitely an exploration within, as opposed to creating a story of fiction, let's say, if you will, or just reporting on something and giving the events that happen. It's looking deep within. So it's a very introspective practice that, you know, the author has to do and be prepared to spend some time, whether that means pulling out photo albums or using writing prompts, which I promote as a tool. You know, if there's a lot of people who know they want to write, but they haven't been able to dial down. For me, it came obviously the general idea, but it wasn't like I just woke up one day and said, I want to write a memoir, but I don't know what to write. But there are people that want to do that because they have that need inside to tell a story, whether it's for legacy and family members, whether it's cathartic. You know, there's people who write about divorce, if they've gone through that and how they've emerged. I mean, basically any subject. You walk into any bookstore, you're going to find a variety of subjects. But that's how memoir is different. It's because of tapping into your own emotions and learning to be comfortable with discerning what they are and what they mean and how they relate to your overall story, and getting comfortable enough and past the discomfort so that you can actually get the words on paper and tell your story. So it's quite a process.
So I'm both intrigued and terrified. Because I know, I really appreciate that definition. Because I have wondered about that. You know, I've had someone say to me they want to write a book about this concept they have, which when they describe it, I'm thinking that's about your experience. That's a memoir thing, right? Mm-hmm. But not about their whole life. And I thought, I wonder how you would do that so that it's not just a recounting. Mm-hmm. But so as you talk about bringing people along into the emotion and the vibrancy of whatever mm-hmm. it is, but you're having to feel that feeling at the same time. Mm-hmm. So for those of us who relate on the Enneagram to the head triad, it'll be a stretch. A good stretch. So what was one thing that you had to get comfortable sharing, though, Carrie? Because you talked about, like, okay, that vulnerable part, you're very obviously clear on what you experienced, but was there a moment when you went, oh, I don't know if I'm going to share this?
I think it was almost everything in a way, because I was so accustomed as a political spouse to protecting my privacy. I had worked at the newspaper, and I fully support the media and what they do and the need for it and respect it. And I feel like it's a important component, but I do know that newspapers and TV, they're all in the business to sell or, you know, make money. With that said, you know, they were going crazy about through this campaign, you know, promoting, they're talking about my husband, and there's a whole lot of politics that was within the politics going on in this city at the time, you know, between the former mayor who ran against my husband, who wanted his old job back. I mean, it's just a little, you know, that's a movie in itself in a way, but everybody can be in one room nowadays. You know, we all just saw four former mayors were together 2 weeks ago and everybody was hugging and saying hello. So it's all good. But at the time it was, because the newspaper was every day, there was something about it. I guarded my privacy so closely. I mean, I've never been the type to misspeak or be flippant with my words or on social media. So, but I was scared to, you know, say anything or, you know, whatever. I mean, I was interviewed as my husband and I left early voting in August of that year of his final campaign. And I was ready, but I wasn't expecting to be interviewed. They didn't talk to him. They talked to me. And all of a sudden I get texts from his team. Good job. Good job. Good job. So I'm like, everybody's paying attention. And even if you think they're not paying attention, they are. And so I had to get used to sharing my words, you know, and being okay with that because, you know, I was comfortable with it. But for so many years, not that people didn't want to hear from me, but my husband was the one that was the elected official. So, I mean, of course, I'm not going to be giving interviews because he's the one elected. So that's okay. But in terms of, you know, fighting past that, do my stories matter? Does my voice matter? Do I have a right to share my stories? I mean, now I can tell anyone all day long that you absolutely do. But this was 2018 when he was still in office and I was starting to write. And I was also fearful. You know, I didn't have a date when the book was going to come out. I just started writing and was looking, you know, for agents and publishers as I was writing. But I was very careful that I didn't want to do or say anything that would affect his, you know, I kept it very close to me. I didn't even tell family members that I was writing the book because I just didn't want anyone to know, because then there'd be an article in the paper. Mayor's wife is writing a book, you know, that kind of thing. So it's just being guarded and getting past that. It took a lot of, but what was stronger than those feelings of privacy and the need for it was the desire to write the book. And, yep. And that's how I got past it, because I kept going back to it and saying, I want to do this. And, you know, again, here I'm going back to the buy-in, but I did share my idea with someone I trusted who was a former writer for the newspaper, and he's published 7 or 8 books on Florida in his own right. And he was in town one day, we had lunch, and, you know, I sent him like a first chapter and he endorsed the idea and gave me some good feedback. And that made me feel like, you know, yes, this is something worth doing. So, and that's, I'm not sure if we're ready to go there yet in the conversation, but that leads into the community that authors and aspiring authors must form.
When we're ready to go there, because that's what occurs to me is the importance of community, and a community that is encouraging as well as truthful, right?
Exactly.
Hey there, everybody. I want to take just a minute out of this episode of the No Labels, No Limits podcast to tell you that we are officially opening the Sandbox membership in September. So if you're not already on our mailing list, please click the link below to either sign up for the membership or get on the waiting list for the membership. And if you click the link, you'll find more information about what's included, what our plans are, and better yet, you'll be on early enough to help decide what is most important to you to experience in the first 3 to 6 months of the membership. So don't wait. Click the link below and join us in the sandbox where fun happens. We get to do a little R&R, little learning, support one another, and really grow and expand in ourselves, in our lives, and impact the world in a profound way. So come on over, join us.
So talk about community and how important that is and how important it was for you.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I've named 3 people already that were in my community. It was, you know, my husband, and I can say that we truly have the kind of relationship that we don't tell each other what the other wants to hear. We can both say the truth and be okay with that. So if he tells me, you know, I wouldn't do this or not to do it, but just I wouldn't do this, or maybe you should say this differently, you know, that kind of thing. I would do the same for him, and it's respected. So going forward, my husband and my friend John, the media guy, Jeff, the former reporter, I involved another local author. She's an award-winning fiction writer, and our kids had gone to school together, and I trusted her because she's not out. She's home writing. She's coming out with her fourth or fifth book soon. But anyway, I trusted her, and for her to give the endorsement of, yeah, this is cool. But, you know, coming from a fiction perspective, she's like, I don't think I could do what you're doing and write it nonfiction. Have you ever considered it writing this story fiction? I'm like, not in this community, because I think people would be trying to guess who's who. So, but with that said, that's four people. I had another, and a friend, you know, a friend that was kind of more neutral, not an author, not, you know, but someone I knew who would tell me the truth. So I kept my community small at the very beginning of five people. And to a fault, I almost kept it too small because I didn't do any pre-author marketing, but that's another subject. But in terms of the, as aspiring writers and authors, you know, having that community, whoever you deem to be important to be in that community, it is important, no matter how independent we are or how accomplished and, you know, capable of writing we may be, we all need that community. I mean, that's why new authors put out advanced reader copies, because they want a community of readers to read their book, give them early feedback, and maybe write a review, you know, because an advanced reader copy is not the final. That's, you know, there could be changes, and that's another form of community. But in terms of a more emotional community that can, you know, give you that validation that I believe we're all looking for to some extent, you know, had I received any negativity around this, I might have looked back and assessed why I'm doing it, but I probably may have, you know, unless everybody gave me negative feedback, maybe I would have put the project on pause. But, you know, I was committed to doing it, and, you know, just felt that with the support of the community that I could get it done.
Well, and you had a strong pull, a strong calling to write it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like, sometimes if you're kind of lukewarm about something and people go, huh, that might be okay. It's like, well, I'm not even that invested in it.
Exactly.
So that's not what I'm hearing from you. You mm-hmm. were invested in it. Mm-hmm. You were willing to listen. And it's vulnerable to ask a community, you know, it feels vulnerable, but it also feels, it feels like a hug sometimes, like, mm-hmm. okay, there's people here watching me. They've got my back. They're going to, you know, mm-hmm. help me out if I need it. Or sometimes just go, tough day writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause it's not like you're just whipping this stuff out easy peasy no. every day. Oh, let's write a book.
Yeah. So,
let's talk about your course. And this is full disclosure to listeners. I'm in Carrie's course. I recommend you get in it. I'm in it partly because I believe in Carrie, but also because I want to push myself. I've written a book before. It was not a memoir. Now looking back, I could have done better. I could have had that more vulnerable part of me in there. So I'm looking forward to learning and expanding and being more truthful because I know myself better now. There is more truth to tell. Mm-hmm. So could you talk about that, Carrie, and share with us kind of your plan for what it's going to be like in the group or what you're going to teach? And
yeah.
who my co-learners might be.
Well, you know, your co-learners are going to be, you know, I think they're going to be authors and aspiring authors at different stages in their projects. Some who may have written nothing yet, but want to learn more. Some who have started writing, some who might have written maybe three quarters, but are also looking into the publishing process and not sure what to do with that. But it's hopefully an all-encompassing course for people who want to write their memoir. It's going to be 4 to 6 modules. I'm tweaking it with the help from you and some others that are my early early students that are giving me some valuable feedback. And what I'm hearing is that people in the course or who would take a course like this would like some form of implementation or homework or something like that. So I'm working on integrating that, but it is overall a 4-module learning course that starts off with not just writing, but more about overcoming imposter syndrome and, you know, believing that you have a story to tell and that your story is valuable and deserves to be told, and ways you can do that, tools you can use to hone in on your story and how to get there. There's also obviously going to be some writing components, organizational components, you know, how to organize, how to sort out the memories and the ideas and such, so that I talked about it here, but I will teach, you know, how to write the mission statement for your book and why that is so valuable. I'm going to share various publishing paths for authors, because there's, you know, basically 3, and they're all different, but none of them is right or wrong. They have advantages and disadvantages, pros and cons. But, you know, I think there used to be I don't know if I'd call it shame, because I didn't think of it like that. But people would kind of say, oh, you had to self-publish. And I didn't self-publish. But for those who did, people would say that, like, oh, you self-published? Oh, you know, that kind of.
Times have changed.
Yeah. And the bottom line is that, you know, you walk into any bookstore or just look online, there are thousands of books every day in the publishing industry. Every Tuesday in the publishing industry is pub day, as they call it, publication day. New books are coming out every Tuesday. So the landscape is large for people who want to write their books. And I think that's, you know, good. A survey from last year revealed that 62% of Americans want to write their memoir. You know, I think people, maybe social media adds to it, or the ease of publishing as well. And when I say social media, I mean that we're all telling our stories every day. If we're posting something on Facebook or Instagram or LinkedIn in some form or fashion, we're telling our story. It might be that small, but people are getting used to sharing. And I think people, the longer people live, for some people, they want to tell it for a legacy reason, you know, to share for their family. But, you know, my course will be for anyone who wants to tell their story, regardless of reason. It doesn't have to be for legacy or, you know, or maybe because they overcame trauma. A lot of people write about trauma, which is becoming more mainstream to talk about anyway, you know, in terms of what we hear and see on the news. People are more forthcoming with their hardships and stuff. So, but memoir, as you can tell from mine, doesn't have to be about, there was some hardship in there, but it wasn't a story of hardship. So that's what my course is going to be. It's also going to include marketing your book, because I think that's an important component that a lot of authors miss. They either aren't thinking about it because they're writing their book and working so hard to get it published, and they find it hard to switch gears. They've spent months, years, what have you, writing this book. And frankly, you know, you're a little exhausted after it. You know, I mean, it's a big task. And so to turn around and then, oh, now I have to market myself and promote myself. What do I do? And the truth is, it doesn't happen after you write your book. It happens 3 to 6 months before you finish your book. But we'll talk more about that in the class and why that is so important and why it's important to get used to promoting yourself and being comfortable with that. No matter what publishing path you take as an author, if you want to sell books besides to your friends or family, you have to market and you have to do a lot of it yourself. So even if you're published traditionally by one of the big 5 or 4, if you will, you're still going to do a lot of the marketing. So it's important to learn how to do it. And there are easy, low cost and no cost ways to do it. So that's in a nutshell what it will cover.
I'm excited. I just was laughing when you said you're tired. I'm thinking, no kidding. but it is good. I mean, I think about having had someone like you, or you in particular, actually would have been great. But just to say, okay,
you're 6 months out from this. Do this now. You know, just do this little thing right now. It's going to help you later. I know you don't want it. Let's do it now.
Right.
I have a question for you. When you talk about legacy, and you know, I work a lot with nonprofits. That's my focus primarily, as well as some solopreneurs. I think about that term legacy. I can't think of any nonprofit that doesn't want to have a lasting legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so I'm wondering, this might be a stretch. So if it is, just say, come on back, Sarah. But I'm wondering, couldn't a nonprofit take the concepts from this course and write a memoir about the nonprofit? Like, why did it start? Something that is, I mean, because that kind of thing is so helpful for bringing people on board, literally and figuratively. But does that concept work in that instance, Carrie?
I think it could. The first thing that jumped into my mind when you said that was an annual report, which is not a memoir, but if you see a nonprofit's annual report, it's a, you know, a lot of it is the statistics and financials are included in that. But within it should be, if it's not, is the story of the organization and what it's about. And like the nonprofit I worked for, Creative Clay, celebrated its 25th anniversary in 2020. So the timing wasn't great because it was during COVID and we couldn't celebrate really the way we wanted to. But the point is we celebrated, and, you know, that whole, I told that story, not in a book form, obviously, but I told that story many times from how it started with, and I wasn't there when the company started, but it started with an idea between two social workers and $1,000 donation from the Knights of Columbus to start Creative Clay, which serves adults with developmental disabilities through arts programming. And now it's grown into, you know, a larger organization with national and international projects and outreach and things. So with that said, absolutely a nonprofit could. I mean, it's not going to be written from an I perspective, but you could tell the stories of the people. If you need to protect privacy, you can absolutely do that. But you may not always have to protect privacy. It depends on the individual and what stories you're telling. But you could absolutely use a memoir framework to tell the story of a nonprofit, because, you know, it's there's growth, there's transformation, there's emotion. Definitely,
there's all of that for sure.
There's characters in the sense of the people who work there, the people who they serve, the people who are the friends and donors. I mean, we've, you know, where I worked, and it's not unique. There's a lot of nonprofits. They've had friends and donors that have been on involved for years, and that they're part of the family.
They are.
And the stories.
So thanks. I'm going to keep that in mind as I'm learning with you.
Sure.
Because I do think that, I mean, some of the reports, and you're right, they normally have some background in the annual. Sometimes they're dry as toast.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, that's interesting. I don't mm-hmm. care. Because I can't feel it, right? I get, like, here's your business case. I don't mean to be callous, but it doesn't make me feel part of that family, because I can't feel it. So I'm going to be glad to learn about how to do this from you. So I do want to ask you one more thing about nonprofits unrelated to writing. And then I have a couple last questions for you. So this is, talk to me about being a puppy raiser.
I could talk to you all day.
I know. That's why I held it till the end.
Well, we are puppy raisers going on. This is our 15th year we are volunteer. I emphasize volunteer because people will ask us, do you work for Southeastern Guide Dogs? And we don't. It's for Southeastern Guide Dogs, who will be changing their name, and I can say this because it's been publicly announced, to Dogs Inc., as in Dogs, INC, to reflect the broader, you know, they serve the whole country. The puppy raisers are around the whole country now. And from a nonprofit perspective, it increases their opportunities for funding. You know, when a national sponsor signs on, yes, because you're not limited to Southeast. So with that said, We, Southeastern Guide Dogs is headquartered about 30 minutes south of where we live in Palmetto, Florida. If anyone's familiar with the west coast of Florida and the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, it's right over the bridge. And we discovered it, I think, when we might have been going to an outlet mall years ago that's not far from there. And we saw a billboard for Southeastern. And I grew up in the pet products industry. My dad started his business in 1965 of manufacturing pet products. And the company still exists today, headquartered in Kentucky now. But I grew up working in that business. 9 years old, I was putting caps on the bottles as my dad filled them and taking them off the screen printing machine and whatever, what have you. And so aside from that, we always had dogs. I mean, they've just been a constant in our life. So to say we love dogs is an understatement. And that's what the question I get almost, not almost every day, but a couple times a week is your next book going to be about dogs? So I don't know yet. But with that said, we discovered Southeastern Guide Dogs, and they used to have puppy hugging. And I would take the kids down there. I was a stay-at-home mom for 10 years. And if the kids had a day off school, we'd go down and just drop in and hug and play with six-week-old Labrador puppies. I mean, what's better than that? So as Southeastern became more programmatic and intentional with their training from practically from day one, and, you know, the minute their eyes open 2 weeks later, you know, starting them on things, they did away with the puppy hugging. It also kept the puppies healthier without bringing in the public before they were fully vaccinated. But our daughter, my kids are Jewish. So our kids were, you know, she needed to come up with a bat mitzvah project in 2009. She was having her bat mitzvah in 2010. And she said, "Can I raise a puppy?" And we're like, "Yeah, that'd be awesome." And you can say, "Wow, she's 12 years old. Can she do this?" And you know, she did as much as a 12-year-old could do. I mean, she couldn't bring the dog to school, but he stayed in her room, and she went to all, we have to go to puppy meetings twice a month for learning and training and such. And it's one of the most rewarding things. So 15 dogs later, we are welcoming a new pup on April 1st named Sky. And we had the honor of naming her, and we named her Sky for the Isle of Skye in Scotland, and where we visited, and it's just gorgeous. But we just love puppy raising because of the independence that these dogs bring to people. And if you talk about storytelling, if you have a minute, go on guidedogs.org and watch some of the videos. They do a tremendous job of telling their story from the perspective of the people that receive the dogs. Because the biggest question we get after loving this dog that we've had from a pup to a 15-month-old for a year, it's part of our family. We've, you know, been through the potty training and all that and so forth. Then we have to take it back for its advanced training. The biggest question we get is, how do you do it? I can't do it. How do you give them back? Well, we give them back because we know they're not our dog, but emotionally we give them back because we know that someone needs them more than we do. And we may love them, and we do. Everybody loves the puppies they raise, and you know, they've all been different, some more challenging than others, but we love them all. But we know that someone needs them more than we do, and it gives them independence. It gives a veteran a chance to, you know, push past PTSD so that they can enjoy life again with their family. It gives a visually impaired person, you know, the opportunity to navigate with their head held high versus with their head lower with a cane. I can't say enough about it. And I say that I've served on boards. I've done other volunteer work. But when you can also volunteer and make friends and people you really enjoy being around through your volunteerism, that's a bonus. I mean, a lot of us puppy raisers, we're friends. I mean, we call it the vortex because you get in and you don't get out.
You can't get out.
Yeah.
I love that about you, Carrie. It's so clear that you come from such a heart-centered place. And that would have been my question to you is, how do you give the dog up? But you're not giving it up. You're moving the dog forward. So
yeah.
And I know you have dogs in your home, so
And their career changed through medical reasons, and so we never say they're failures. And that's the one I take to Tampa General Hospital. She's an ambassador, and she's also a certified therapy dog that goes in and sees patients. And, you know, talk about being in an awesome space with someone when they are at their most vulnerable. I mean, we've seen people who are waiting for a transplant, or one day we got called in before a woman was being moved to hospice to go see her. And I'm like, to be in this presence of someone at that stage in their life, sometimes with their family members, you know, with your dog, is just, I can't, you know, and I'm just
it's
there.
An honor.
Yeah, it is. So I don't.
And you can watch the energy in the room change.
Yes.
Like the minute the dog is there, it's like it's magic.
Yeah, it really is. And so she has a gift. So
here's my second to last question for you.
Okay.
One of the things I like to ask all my guests is if they've had a chance to listen to the podcast, and if so, is there an episode or a guest that they took a golden nugget from that they can share back with the audience? Because I like to think about paying forward what we don't even know yet.
You know, I listened to episode 338, which was one of your most recent episodes about thriving with ADHD and high sensitivity. And you had two lovely guests on there that were so brilliant in their own fields. You know, I have a niece with ADHD. I mean, I guess we can say most everyone probably knows someone who has it. And I've always been kind of interested in it. And I don't know a lot about it. You know, one of my friend's daughters, who happens to be my daughter's friend, was diagnosed at like 25 with it. Very high achieving, brilliant, you know, whatever. But the part I found most compelling was not just their personal stories and experiences, but was the high sensitivity component around that. And that, you know, how sensitivity can be regarded as a negativity in some senses. Oh, you're so sensitive. Oh, you can't, you know, what's wrong with you kind of thing. And I don't think I have ADHD. I have no reason to think I do, but I know that I'm a sensitive person. And, you know, and I used to not be that proud of that fact. But now I think it's an asset. And even those who are maybe not as sensitive doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. But I believe that sensitivity gives you a different insight into, you know, looking at people differently or hearing things differently on another level. And I really enjoyed that. And I appreciated the component with that someone who may have ADHD is highly sensitive also. And that brings with it, while it could be hard to navigate that road, you know, especially as a child, I think, or a young adult, but that it's really an asset in a lot of ways because of the sensitivity that you bring to the table and what you have to contribute because you see things differently.
Yeah. Yeah. That was Tamara and Yoli who mm-hmm. were on there, and both amazing, right, in the work that they do. And they're very curious about the overlaps in the mm-hmm. work that they do. So thanks for sharing that, because sure. I agree with you. They brought some insights, and Tamara's whole thing is your brain isn't broken if you have ADHD.
Right.
But I had learned from them. We're working with this. He's working with us. A service guy is doing some work at our house. And one of the first things he told me when we met him at his shop, he says, I'm sorry, I have ADHD. I have to tell you right now, that's why the TV's on. So he's telling me all this. And then not long ago, my husband gets this text from him. I says, he's not going to be able to communicate that way with you. He's in five other different places in his brain.
Uh-huh.
See if you can have a phone call with him.
Right. Yeah, interesting. But,
I'm not sure I would have thought about that in that way, other than be like, what is going on with this weird communication thing?
Yeah.
So I appreciate that too. And so thanks for sharing that. I'll make sure we cut that part out and they get a heads up on it. And I'm be curious, because I know a lot of people will take away from what we're doing here. So my last question for you,
mm-hmm.
for now,
sure,
today, I know you have a gift that you will give our folks if they go to your website. So I'd like for you to say that. But also, can you share with us, if anybody's listening and they want to get in on your class, it's going to open in May. So can you talk a little bit about that and how anybody could find out more about that specifically, Carrie?
Sure. My class launches May 20th. And if you go to my website, carriekreisman.com, it's KerryKreisman.com. There is a tab right up at the top that says enroll in Make Memoir Magic. And you can find out about the class. There's some details on there about it. And then you can join the wait list. And that means you join my email list and you will receive information when enrollment opens. And you'll also get to receive some emails from me to get used to my conversational tone, what I might be sharing with you. I try to share some nuggets each week, you know, with my subscribers that they can hopefully find useful in their writing practice. So I encourage anyone to just go to my website, check it out. I have a blog if you want to read any of my writing. And so I also have some free resources on my website as well, such as a writing prompts guide and, a goal setting guide. I have a 20 strategies to write your memoirs. I've got a couple other things on there. So I definitely encourage anyone to go there and check that out. So
we will have the links to that in our show notes like we do every week with our guests. So don't, if you missed how she spelled her website, don't worry about it. The hyperlink will be in the show notes. So Carrie, as we end this podcast, I'm going to give you the last word. What is one word of encouragement that you give aspiring writers who are on the fence?
Believe. If it's one word, I would say believe, because I believe that aspiring authors need to believe in the value of their stories, and that if they want to tell their stories, they should absolutely do so. And that they should believe that they have the capability to do it. Now, we are all at different stages of our writing, but, you know, there are resources if you feel like you need to hone your writing skills or grammar and so forth. But in terms of what's in your heart, you need to believe that it's worth telling.
Okay, No Labels, No Limits podcast listeners, there you have it, believe. And, you know, that's one of the tenets of the philosophy of the podcast, right? You have to believe in yourself so that you can get past or around or engage with limiting labels and beliefs. So until next week, everybody, have a good week. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review it. Share it with someone else. Maybe you have a friend who you're thinking, man, they've told you a story and you think they should write a book. Send them the link to this podcast so they can get connected with Carrie. I'm not getting any kickbacks on this. I'm just telling you this because I believe in Carrie and who she is and how she shows up. And I think that's it for this week. We'll come back with another great guest soon. Thanks, Carrie.
All right. Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been listening to the No Labels, No Limits podcast with best-selling author, change agent, and strategic business coach, Sarah Box. You can grab the show notes and find out how to work with Sarah at sarahbox.com/no-labels-no-limits-podcast. We'd love this podcast to reach as many people as possible. Please remember to rate, leave a 5-star review, and share the podcast with someone you think would get value from this conversation. Till next time, keep taking those daily action steps to align your purpose to your principles and achieve your goals in business and life.